This is the Cato Daily Podcast for Monday, October 9th, 2017. I'm Caleb Brown. Speech that is extreme still deserves protection from government censorship, and drawing the line between acceptable speech and extremist or hate speech is virtually impossible. Cato senior fellow Fleming Rose spoke with me about extreme speech and the effort currently underway in Italy and elsewhere to begin regulating so-called fake news. I see protesters who are holding up signs quite often. One in particular, it said, "Hate speech is not free speech," and hashtag take a knee. And the idea was that, I guess, sort of mixing the various memes and protest movements. One is arguing that freedom of speech does not include speech at the extreme ends, and that a silent protest of taking a knee, of quietly protesting something, this is appropriate. This is the how we're meant to make use of our rights to free speech. You draw a distinction that a lot of people don't draw. You draw a distinction between speech that is merely offensive or awful in a way, and speech that is dangerous. So why is it important that we make that distinction between extremist speech and speech that is dangerous?
Because fundamental First Amendment principle is viewpoint neutrality. And when it comes to hate speech, first, there is no clear definition of what hate speech is. You know, one man's hate speech may be another man's poetry. And if you engage in, or if you try to define the limits of free speech with references to extremist speech or hate speech, you very easily end up in a situation where you will tend to shut down speech that you don't like. And not necessarily speech that in fact constitutes a clear and present danger of violence. That's why I prefer the concept of dangerous speech when we discuss the legitimate limits on speech in a liberal democracy. Extremism doesn't mean much in and by itself. I mean, what do you prefer? A moderate defender of fascism or an extremist supporter of liberal democracy? It all comes down to the context. And it also changes across time and cultures and countries. If you take the abolitionist movement in the United States in the 18th, 19th century, it engaged in extremist speech. If you take the social and political norms of the time as a measure stick, so I would be very careful to use extremist speech or extremism as some kind of measure stick when it comes to the debate about what the legitimate limits on speech should be in a liberal democracy.
And as you note, hate speech doesn't really mean anything, and it as it a legal
basically
matter,
that just means speech that I don't like.
And as a legal matter, it definitely doesn't mean anything because it can mean so many different things in different contexts. There are people who are concerned, however, about creating a climate of fear. In which people, we've talked about hate crimes in the past, whatever that might mean in any given circumstance. But there are people who say that there's a world of difference between beating somebody up and leaving them on the street, and beating somebody up and leaving them on the street, and then painting some sort of swastika or a hammer and sickle on a wall as you do it, or yelling some sort of epithet as you do it, and that these are very different in a way when it comes to how we punish those kinds of activities.
I don't think it makes a lot of difference to the victim. I mean, the victim is the target of a crime, no matter what the motivation. I think that there may be legitimate reasons for having this sense of a climate of fear, but I just don't think that the best way to fight it is by using the measure stick of hate speech versus non-hate speech as a guideline.
We've talked about this before in a related matter, and I think it's worth repeating. Why is it important that we not punish hate crimes as a separate matter than we punish an identical crime that has no sort of specific content to a message that is sent in the crime?
Because it will reinforce this problematic notion that there is a direct correlation between hate speech and hate crimes, that evil words will lead to evil deeds. And in order to fight it, we do not only have to punish the perpetrator of the actual crime, but we will also have to punish speech that we allege lead to these kind of crimes. And the fact of the matter is that there is no documented or clear link between evil speech and evil deeds, though, of course, there is a link between speech and violence. It's just, I think, more complicated, as there are many more factors at play than just speech. And still, the best way to fight this is with more speech, not less speech.
So, how do you evaluate groups like these white supremacists and white nationalists, or as I like to say, whatever stupid distinction they want to make about themselves to make them seem less offensive, and Antifa groups? One, they marched in Charlottesville. At least one of them became extremely violent and killed a person. And yet, on the other side, Antifa has made a sort of a public showing of saying that anyone who is articulating fascist ideas on street corners or anywhere else, they're going to take pains to shut that person down, in their words, or in some folks, Antifa folks' words, to prevent them from recruiting.
Mm-hmm. I mean, when it comes to the First Amendment, I don't think there is any difference in the sense that we approach the First Amendment and the interpretation of the First Amendment based on viewpoint neutrality. So it's, if it's radical left or if it's radical right, it's the same in terms of the same of the First Amendment, that the red line that you're not allowed to cross is incitement to violence or incitement incitement to a threat of violence. That is not protected speech, no matter whether it's white supremacist speech or antifa. Fascist speech. And I think that there is an interesting comparison to be made when it comes to the neo-Nazis and the white supremacists between the 1977 Skokie affair and the rally in Charlottesville that erupted in violence and clashes. In 1977, neo-Nazis marched through Skokie, Illinois, a town where at that time a majority of the population were Holocaust survivors, or at least many Holocaust survivors lived in that town. And they wanted to march through Skokie wearing Nazi symbols like the swastika. And this was considered by the Supreme Court in the end as protected speech, even though it was extremist, it was very offensive and hurtful to these Holocaust survivors, but it was not dangerous speech. People in Charlottesville marched more or less, committed to the same ideology, but they were wearing weapons. They clashed with counter demonstrators, and one individual was killed, and I think dozens were injured. And that kind of speech is not protected by the First Amendment. So you can have, in fact, this Nazi ideology In one case, in fact, being expressed in a way so that it is protected by the First Amendment, but in another case when it involves threats of violence and actual violence, it's not protected speech. And I would say the same goes for the Antifa. I think on a broader societal level, even though there is some concern now, I think the anti-fascist movement has a broader appeal, its ideology, to more mainstream circles on the ideology, not the violence. I don't think anyone would condone the violence, but the fact that you have to oppose right-wing ideology and things like that, I think it has a broader support than neo-Nazi ideology. But that's just my sense.
All right, let's shifting gears just a little bit. You have a piece upcoming dealing with how Italy has decided to deal with this scourge of fake news, which I'll admit is a problem. But it's a problem for consumers to contend with. I don't think it's a problem for speech per se. But in Italy, they've taken a very sort of specific and very restrictive attack with it. What have they proposed to do?
Well, the antitrust chief of the Italian government, Giovanni Pietrocella, he just published a book, and in several articles he has agitated for the point of view that the government should get involved in the verification of information, and he also wants the government to provide the government with the necessary authority to remove what it defines as fake news and fine media companies that do not obey. But this is not only an Italian issue. It's in fact going on in Europe on a broader scale. The German government passed a law that makes it possible to fine companies like Google, Facebook, Twitter, up to 50 million euros, 50 million euros, that's more than $50 million, if they do not take down what they define as hate speech or fake news quickly enough. To me, this sounds as a ministry of truth. I don't think it's up to the government to engage in conversations and debates about what is the truth. That to me sounds like something I know from the Cold War in the Soviet Union, where it was a criminal offense to deliberately disseminate what the government saw as false information. And that was exactly the article that was used by the Soviet government to lock up dissidents. And I understand that we have a different tradition and a different, better protected culture of free speech in Western Europe, but I don't think the Europeans are that much different by nature. So if you start providing the government with these kind of authorities, I'm quite sure that that authority will be used, as Pietrocella, in fact, himself acknowledged in a piece in the Financial Times earlier this year, in which he said that, you know, we need this in order to fight populism, which is, as far as I understand, a legitimate political movement. They are in the Italian parliament, this five-star movement. You can agree or disagree with it, but it's within the law. And now people on the other side of the political spectrum, they want laws that makes it possible for them to crack down on what they understand as populism.
Is there any appetite for that in the United States, do you think? I mean, based on how the people are talking about Russian interference with respect to the 2016 election, there seems like there may
Absolutely.
Be an appetite for that kind of restriction.
I mean, I recently saw a surprising opinion poll, I think it was Economist and YouGov, on whether Republicans and Democrats in the United States would be in favor of fining U.S. media if they publish so-called fake news. And it's around 50% of Americans who would be in favor of such a guideline. That's concerning, and it says, you know, even though you have the First Amendment in the United States and you have the best protection in the world of free speech, this is also a matter of culture, and it's a matter of social pressures, is a matter of the way individuals and organizations understand themselves free speech and its limits. Not everybody has the resources to turn to the courts. So free speech is not safe in and by itself just because of the First Amendment. There are many other factors at play.
So do you believe that we're sort of in a transition period from print media, where, you know, the press was only free if you had one, into the internet era, where anyone can essentially publish or buy ads that say whatever they want to say? Is it your belief that we're just sort of in a transition period, and at some point, without government intervention, that this problem will be settled?
Yeah, I mean, it's difficult to say, and it's clear that this is a disruptive technology in many ways. And it makes a lot of people feel uncomfortable. How are we going to manage this? Also in terms of the terrorist threat, the sharing of jihadist material on the internet, the recruitment of ISIS warriors traveling from the West to Syria and so on and so forth. But I think there is a precedent in history that we could benefit from taking a look at. And that is the invention of the printing press by Johann Gutenberg in the 15th century. That was also a disruptive technology that for the first time made mass circulation of newspapers, books, leaflets possible. Like we now have the smartphone that makes everybody connected to one another if they have a smartphone. Back then, it was a printing press, and in the beginning, this was seen as, you know, a huge big breakthrough. But very quickly, state power and the church started to try to control this technology, and they introduced heavy censorship. You had witch hunts, you had the burning of heretics on stakes, you had the killing of blasphemers, especially in Catholic countries, and so on and so forth. And you had the Catholic Church, you know, introducing this index on banned books at the time of the Inquisition, and that was also a reaction to the invention of the printing press. And looking back on that period, it turns out that the states and the parts of Europe that in that introduced the most severe censorship, they in fact fell behind. So I think the conclusion is, when you have these kind of new disruptive technologies, it's better to wait a bit and focus more on the upsides of the technology than the downsides, and not take immediate action to limit freedom of expression.
Fleming Rose is the 2016 recipient of the Milton Friedman Prize for Advancing Liberty. He's also a senior fellow at the Cato Institute. Subscribe to and rate the Cato Daily Podcast at iTunes and Google Play, and follow us on Twitter at Cato Podcast.